United States against Ortiz. Ms. Siegel.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel. May it please the Court, my name is Janet Siegel. I represent the appellant, Adolfo Ortiz. Mr. Ortiz pleaded guilty to being present in the United States after his removal to Mexico following a conviction for retail theft in Wisconsin. The sole issue on appeal here is whether the district court erred in applying a 16-level crime of violence increase to his base offense level in calculating...
That's not the sole issue on appeal. It is the only argument you present, but the United States says the answer to that question doesn't make any difference because of your client's battery conviction. So we will need to discuss that question, too.
Certainly, and I'm happy to start with the harmless error argument. The government does argue that even if the district court erred, the error is harmless because Mr. Ortiz has a prior conviction for misdemeanor battery under Wisconsin law, which the government contends was categorized as, under the habitual offender statute and therefore constitutes a felony for federal sentencing purposes. We simply can't know here what the district court would have done in this instance. I don't
understand that. What the district court would have done is not the open question. We need to know how that conviction is classified for federal purposes. That's a question of law, not of the district judge's discretion.
Certainly.
The critical question is whether you have any argument that that conviction doesn't count for current purposes.
There's no
evidence. Peters, that conviction under that statute does, and one would think that Peters rather ends the dispute.
There is no there's no documentation in the record from the state court concerning that offense. There's the representation in the PSR that it was sentenced as a habitual offender. In terms of whether the misdemeanor battery under Wisconsin law was sentenced as a habitual offender and therefore constitutes a felony.
No. Whether it was sentenced as a habitual offender is irrelevant. The question is, what was the maximum possible sentence under state law?
Right. If it was only the misdemeanor, then it was that it would not constitute a felony for purposes here. If it was under the habitual offender statute, it would have been eligible for up to 2 years imprisonment and would be a felony for sentencing purposes here. But in any event, error is harmless only if it didn't affect the district court's selection of the sentence imposed. The two cases cited by the government are district court cases in which the district court clearly said, even in the alternative, I would impose the same sentence. So in both of those cases, the district court said, I'm sentencing based on X, but even if it was Y, the sentence would be the same.
I'm lost, counsel. I don't understand why that matters. The question here is not discretion in sentencing. The question is whether a particular prior conviction elevates the range, right? What difference does it make whether it's conviction A rather than conviction B that elevates the range under the guidelines?
Well, there are two separate issues. One is whether the prior battery offense actually does constitute a crime of violence, and based on the evidence that's in the record here, I don't know if there is possibly an argument that it was not properly categorized.
And that you lose me there, too. We don't go with evidence behind the conviction. All we need to know is what he was convicted of. That's the critical thing.
Right, he was convicted of a misdemeanor battery charge. So then there's the question of whether it's a felony for federal sentencing purposes, which would make it eligible for the crime of violence increase. So there's the potential that...
He was convicted of the habitual misdemeanor, which is a two-year offense under Wisconsin law.
Battery appears
to meet the other definitional requirements for a crime of violence in this circumstance.
That's what was represented in the PSR. There's no detailed information about that because it wasn't considered as the basis for the crime of violence increase. So we can't tell whether perhaps there might have been some basis for challenging that.
You're just totally losing me. We can't tell. This is your client's conviction. Your client knows what he was convicted of. The PSR represents that he was convicted of battery as a habitual offender. He didn't deny it at sentencing. I don't know what's missing.
But, of course, at that time, it wasn't being considered for a 16-level crime of violence increase. It was only in there for the purpose of the two-point criminal history. So he may not have even, you know, I can't speculate about what defense counsel may have done below, but may not have even considered whether there was an inaccuracy or a challenge to be made there because it was irrelevant to the sentencing. That two-point criminal history made no difference in his ultimate sentence. Perhaps if it was the basis for a 16-level increase, there might have been some challenge that would have been made. And in any event, here, you know, the law is clear that the defendant is entitled to know the basis for any increases in the calculation of the sentencing range, that the court, that he then has the opportunity to object to it, as the court then has to make a ruling on that. And none of that happened here, so we have no record below, and the defendant never had his opportunity to make those challenges if there were any to be made.
If there were that opportunity, what would he say? Is there any basis to challenge what was in the PSR?
I don't know. I have not retrieved his state court records on this offense from Wisconsin.
Yeah, well.
And it's not in the,
but
it's
look,
not in the record.
The United States has said the judgment should be affirmed on this basis. There were no challenge made in the district court, and you are unwilling to tell us that there is any basis for such a challenge. So it hardly seems appropriate to remand.
Well, again, as I indicated, perhaps defense counsel didn't elect to make that challenge because it wasn't serving.
The reason to hold hearings in district court is to resolve factual disputes. If there is no factual dispute, there's no point in holding a hearing. And you haven't identified any factual dispute.
Well, we can't know if there was some basis
yes,
for making that challenge.
Yes, we can know. It's your own client's conviction. He's got a copy of it. All he needs to do is say, or you need to do some legal research.
Well, I would put forth that here, in any event, the district court has considerable discretion, even if there, even if this prior offense did constitute the basis for a 16-level increase. The court had the discretion to go below the guidelines range in imposing a sentence, and perhaps if a different offense were the basis for the 16-level increase, the judge might have been more receptive, excuse me, to an argument decrease the sentence. Here, the judge did focus considerably on the false imprisonment offense as the basis for imposing the sentence because she believed that it demonstrated the defendant's violent inclination.
If we say that doesn't count because it doesn't have violence as an element, it doesn't mean it goes away or that his behavior was different. Right? You seem to be thinking that the district judge would then ignore it.
I don't suggest that the district judge would ignore that, but that seemed to be the primary focus of the court's discussion at sentencing because it was the basis for this very significant increase. And perhaps if it had not been, the judge might have been more receptive to the argument that there were mitigating factors that should have resulted in a lower sentence.
Gee.
I can see that I'm going into my rebuttal time, so I will reserve.
Thank you, Ms. Siegel. Mr. Yarish.
Before I go into the harmless error argument, just think that the issue regarding Billups in this case is whether or not Billups holds that the Wisconsin false imprisonment statute never has, as an element, the attempted use or threatened use of physical force. And if that is the case, that it never has that, then the government's argument is foreclosed, and we just simply go to the harmless error argument. We don't think that Billups holds that. We think that there's room in Billups, certainly for the interpretation that the element of use, attempted use, or threatened use of physical force is available. We've derived that from two parts of the Billups decision. The first part, Billups says there is no requisite element within the Wisconsin false imprisonment statute requiring physical force And we certainly agree that in not every permutation would physical force be required. But saying that it is never required doesn't mean the same thing as saying
it's not an element. It's not an element. It can't get to be an element through the back door. It's just not an element.
Well, it's not an element in every case, but it doesn't mean it can't be an element. In other words, there is a permutation.
I don't understand that. Something is an element or it isn't.
Well,
you seem to be confusing, or at least your brief seemed to be confusing, the element of the offense with what the guy did in fact. And the Supreme Court has been pretty clear, I think, in Taylor and Shepard, that what he did in fact matters only insofar as it tells us what he has been convicted of.
And I would agree,
well,
Your Honor.
He has not been convicted of a crime of which violence is an element, at least not that crime.
Well,
battery, it is an element.
Now, and I would agree that both below and in the brief, we concentrate on the conduct, or we talk about the conduct. But I would like to make it clear that we're talking about the conduct to determine what element of the statute he was convicted under. And that becomes important in the element that's within the statute dealing with something being without consent. And when you look at the without consent definition, it contains three subparts. And though that element, subsumed under those three subparts, become part of the elements of the crime.
Actually, it's the way it's structured, there's four possibilities.
Well, and certainly, the first being no consent in fact, and then the three subparts. I believe that's what the court might be referring to.
Are they mutually exclusive?
They're not mutually exclusive, but I think that what's happened here, and as the defense pointed out in its reply brief, what's happening is the no consent in fact is being subsumed under the first subdivision, which is obtaining consent by the threat of force or violence. Because it would be an odd situation, would it not, if a person could say, well, I consented, but I consented because of the threat of fear, threat of violence, threat of physical force, but at the same time saying I did not consent or I did not consent?
Yeah, I understand the argument that that's odd as a factual matter. That's not how crimes go down.
Right.
But that's how the statute is structured legally, and we're kind of stuck with it. And this is not one of those statutes that has its own definition of non-consent, as some Wisconsin crimes do, with the generic definition. And so what we say about this statute has implications across the whole array of the Wisconsin criminal code anyway, and to the extent that other states have similar codes. So we got to get the interpretation right, at least for purposes of the element analysis that the Chief Judge was discussing earlier.
Right.
So this is different from Billups.
Well, it is different in that sense, and I don't have a good answer for that other than the practicality of what happens in these sort of cases, which the court is alluding to, and that is that when a victim comes in, they're going to be interviewed for the whole ambit of activities that went on.
Right, and it's going to be charged that way. It won't be charged necessarily under the subsection of the definition that involves use of force, even though everybody in court is going to refer to it as a use of force false imprisonment. And when the victim is asked the non-consent question on the witness stand, she's going to say, I didn't consent, I was forced. So as a practical matter, you can have situations where there's no consent in fact, and in fact there's consent obtained by use of force, even though, legally speaking, the way the definition is structured, it looks like those two things are mutually exclusive.
If I could, I would like to just address the harmless error argument.
Okay.
In that regard, the court had a guideline range of 77 to 96 months. If the battery holds as a conviction, as a crime of violence, which under the Peters case it should be, the guideline range would be exactly the same. The court gave the defendant 77 months, commenting on his overall behavior and violent tendency, and as a result, there's no reason to think that anything other than the 77 months would occur here. nor is there any reason to think that a remand would produce anything other than what we have before us right now. Government would respectfully request that the judgment and conviction order be affirmed unless the court has any other questions. I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Yarish. Anything further, Ms. Siegel?
I did just want to comment in closing on the issue of without consent, because I do think this is important to note that the district court, and it's clear from the sentencing transcript, did not make the distinction between the no consent in fact and consent that's obtained through some other manner, including through violence. And it's clear from the comments in the sentencing transcript that the court looked at the fact that Mr. Ortiz grabbed the victim by the arm and pulled her back into the car, stating that these uncontested acts show that the conviction is properly characterized as a crime of violence. And so the district court applied the wrong analysis. It shouldn't have been whether violent means were used. It should have been whether consent was obtained or not. And here, the criminal complaint itself shows that throughout the incident, the victim repeatedly demanded that she be allowed out of the car. She screamed at him, and she asked to be released from the car. So she never consented, in fact. So even though it may be a little odd that there's this one no consent possibility and the with consent coerced through some kind of force, and there might be some overlap, it was very clear from the facts here that that was not the case, that no consent was given throughout the incident. And so that should have been the analysis that the district court applied. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. And Ms. Siegel, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case. So the case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess until next week.